They're bad. They're boys. And occasionally, they talk about running. Yes, it's the Bad Boy Running Podcast with your hosts, Jody Rainsford and David Heller. Come back.
Baby, come back. With a bye, 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 bye. With a bye, 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 bye. I must admit I was a clone to be messing around. But that doesn't mean that you have to leave town.
Hey, Duke Badders. Welcome to Bad Boy Running. We've got an absolute treat for you today. I've been wanting to get Mary on for ages, and I thought she was ignoring me, and I think she probably was, but maybe she didn't see the message. And eventually, I don't know why, she decided to come on. I'm as amazed as probably she will be by the end of this podcast. But if you don't know about Mary, Mary was the fastest female runner in America. She went to Nike and just had a terrible time, shall we say, under Salazar. Since then, though, she's actually done some incredible things, which is the main reason why we've got on the podcast, actually. She's started a running club called Atalanta NYC with some other runners who you may have heard of, people like Alison Felix. And it seems to be revolutionizing the way in which club teams work. So to tell us about that, welcome to the podcast, Mary Kane!
Thanks so much for having me. And I will start off by saying I am horrible at checking my Instagram messages. And by that, I mean, like, I probably reply to like 1% of them because I just have this like day of panic where I'm like, oh my God, all these poor nice people have reached out to me. And then I get overwhelmed and then I'm out. You know, I mean, you guys probably see my grid on social. It's like one picture of my dog, picture of my boyfriend, and then like really intense running comment, and then nothing.
How many, because we don't have to deal with those issues of being overwhelmed by people wanting to contact us. Like what was your, because what have you got? You've got 70,000 maybe, or 60,000, or what was the growth of that like? Were there certain triggers, and how do you actually manage?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest trigger, of course, is just the New York Times piece. I think overnight I had gained everybody. The recent Rich Roll podcast definitely like sent like more of a spike. But I think in general, I'm just somebody who's very curmudgeonly, and I didn't get, and you know, I'm 25, so I recognize that I'm young, but like for my generation, I got a like phone that had internet capabilities very late. I didn't get that until I was like 18. I didn't get one until I could buy one on my own. So I definitely like didn't grow up with it. And so I think I'm still learning how to be more, you know, on social media, because I think people really like demonize it, even though there's so many really powerful, great uses for it. And all that you really need to do is kind of figure that out as an individual. And I just haven't quite done that yet.
I tell you what, after this, we're going to add literally tens of people to that Instagram account. Tens.
And because I imagine you get a lot of terrible people messaging you. Is that just because of in some ways what you represent is and what you're trying to change? People don't want to change necessarily. Like, do you get a lot of criticism? Well, not criticism. Yeah, criticism, I guess. Trolling, like just disgusting mails, or.
You know, it's actually really funny. I don't know if there's some like algorithm that like saves me from it, but I think I'm so overwhelmed generally by positive messages that I don't notice the negative ones. And if anything, if I do, they just kind of give me a laugh because I'm like, oh, poor guy who really hates me talking about therapy might really need it right now.
Poor guy talking about helping people. Oh. Yeah. And those are the messages generally kind of just like I'm really supportive of what you do, or like what would your breakdown of your messages? Because we've never really talked about Instagram actually, have we? And having to because there was a time when emails just got overwhelming. It's now WhatsApp. Yeah. But I'd imagine Instagram's slightly different in that you don't necessarily know the people and haven't got control how people contact you. What does it tend to be?
Yeah, I guess it really varies. I mean, I think there's sometimes just like spammy ones where it's just, you know, that there's always like the weird guy in some other country trying to hit on you and you're just like, delete, sorry.
He was trying to get you on the podcast. That was it. That's David's
approach. Just my way.
He does it with everyone. It comes across like that. He's just really keen. That's it.
Exactly. And then otherwise, it's a lot of just research out about like how people can get involved, and just lending support, sometimes sharing their stories. And I think when I say like overwhelmed, I say that in a very, I think we think of that in a negative context, but I don't. Like when I say overwhelmed by messages, I just more mean like literal ability to find time and day to give people almost like the full, I almost feel, response that they deserve by reaching out. And the problem is that sometimes I can be very all or nothing with things where it's like, I either want to sit down for an hour and do it, or if I only have maybe like 15, I'm just like, that's not good enough. I can't do it. And the truth is, that's a horrible way of thinking. So nobody should listen to me and use that model of thought. But yeah, I do need to find a way in my chaotic schedule to make sure I'm like purposefully going on, or at least getting a little bit more like into my own personal social media.
Yeah. No, I mean, and I think particularly if they are really nice messages and potentially people who are looking for help, or then that's the hardest part, isn't it? How do you balance your own time against helping people? Let's start with the new running club, which Atalante. I mean, that to me is annoyingly confusing with Atlanta. And
all the Italian football team Atalanta as well.
Is there an Italian football team?
Yeah.
So is it an Italian? Why is it called Atalanta?
It's Greek mythology, or you know, I took Latin when I was younger. I took it for 7 years, and here in the States, at least, when you take a language, a lot of schools have it where you take a name that's supposed to be like that language version. So if you're in French and Spanish, it's super easy. But if you're in something bizarre like Latin, you can pick from like the eclectic world of Greek mythology and Roman mythology. And I, as a sixth grader, had no running background. At this point, my fifth grade mile PR was like 6:10. And I had Googled, and by I mean my dad had Googled that was pretty fast. So we were naturally convinced I was going to the Olympics off of zero running experience. So he was like, why don't you do Atalanta? Like, that seems like it would be fun. She's the fastest being ever alive. She was faster than all the men, all the gods.
No pressure.
Exactly. And it was one of those things where it was like a super, you know, just fun myth, because for anybody who's nerdy like myself and enjoys mythology, you know that no myth is like good for women. And as things go, is like, like a B, like we got a B somewhere. It's not an A, it's not an A plus. This is some like amazing feminist story. But I think really I was always struck by the fact that this was the story of a woman who really kind of overcame the powers that be and was constantly fighting against it to stand up and do something and live a life that she wanted. And for in the myth, at least, that was like being an athlete, being a warrior, which was not exactly back then, and I think even today it always is celebrated in the way that it was for men. And so as we were building this team, I always had this fascination with story, and I was talking to a coworker of mine in New York Roadrunners, which is the organization here that puts on the marathon, and I work part-time there, and she had been on a team back in the 1980s. It was founded in the 1970s. It was called Atalanta NYC, and it was the first ever women's high performance team here in the United States, and it was based in New York City. And so it just felt like this perfect like combination of myth, which I love, like personal backstory, and then running history to it. And I'll say, when we had calls about it, there was concerns like, maybe they'll be confused about Atlanta. And I think one, our mission is so strong that nobody cares. They're just like, hey, we're here for it. And to the amount of people who immediately knew what the myth was. I was like, oh, I found my Greek mythology friends. Let's go.
That's really cool. And what happened to that, to the original team?
They were a team from like the 1970s to 1990s. And I believe, you know, from the little I've been able to kind of see online, it seems like it just kind of naturally faded out. And so they're no longer a team. It's no longer in existence. And I think, ironically, like what often, you know, can start to happen, I think within a lot of like women, like feminist history, is that once things have been almost like normalized for a certain amount of time, there's this really positive moment where women's opportunities start to just kind of blend into men's. But it's similar to like what we see in Title IX, where women's sports pre-Title IX had like an incredible amount of women's coaches in it. And then as soon as more opportunities were created and it became more of like a financially strong thing, all of a sudden there were no opportunities because things were like kind of quote unquote better. And so I think that very often is like a thing where, you know, all women's groups have slowly kind of faded out to become more co-ed because there are more opportunities to be co-ed. But I think in those instances, there's sometimes then this, like, you know, rather than it, women being celebrated as women, we're the little men on the team.
And what's Title IX?
Title IX in the States is like an NCAA. Often that's, you know, what we're kind of talking about, where it made all teams that were a part of, I think, just D1 and D2 sports have to have an equal number of male and female scholarships awarded to athletes. And so if you look in sports, you know, there's more scholarships taken up by men's football in most like major teams than almost anywhere else. And so Title IX was this way to say, hey, you can't, you know, fill a roster of like 80 guys and then have zero women because there is no football in the school. And so it's this way to kind of even it out. And that's why if you look at a lot of like major football programs, you'll sometimes see that they have more women's teams overall, or they'll have more scholarships for, say, women's track versus men's track, because it's a way to fulfill Title IX requirements to give women more opportunity in sports.
Wow, that's really interesting. And does that mean that, for as you say, because it's balanced over the college rather than the sport, does that mean, for example, male track athletes are basically buggered because they're in competition with a football player? Has it caused all these weird imbalances in different sports for some for men, some for women?
Yeah, normally. And that's why there are sometimes like, there's a lot more maybe like niche women's sports within schools than niche men, because they can, you know, maybe they need like the women's sailing team to kind of bolster the number of scholarships that they have available, say men sailing. And so that was a big issue actually over the course of the last year, where a lot of college programs, which bluntly only care about like the money-making sports, which are only men's sports, were trying to cut a lot of different programs at schools, and men's track were often the ones that were attempted to be cut. And there was this really, really great push by like not only the running community, but a lot of people. And Russell Dinkins, who is an 800 meter runner, who's a Princeton grad, was one of the people who was like really spearheading the charge to say like, this is horrible and you shouldn't be doing this, especially when a sport like men's track and field is one of the most, if not often the most diverse sport within a lot of these university systems. And so to like axe that doesn't make any sense when you're really kind of looking at like, what is the point of a college having sports? And there's really two points. It's either one, money, which not a lot of schools actually succeed with, if we're just being honest with ourselves. And then two, it's like opening up opportunities in a theoretical sense for people to become more well-rounded individuals, and sports is an opportunity for people to become that.
And is this known now? Will we have parents where they'll intentionally try and push their kids into their daughters into certain whack sports because it's a cheaper way of getting an education?
Yeah, it actually kind of is. And it's a thing, unfortunately, for like wealthy white families to do, you know, where it's like a way for somebody to kind of cheat the system. Because sometimes these niche sports like are super expensive. You're not nonchalantly going to suddenly join the women's sailing team. Like you'd have to have that resource to have a boat that you can use and, you know, all those sorts of things. So it's not exactly something where you're seeing it opened up where maybe people who wouldn't have been able to get a college education otherwise are suddenly getting it. I would actually be really curious to see, you know, what like that breakdown of like socioeconomic background kind of looks like between even male female sports, because of like the different sports and the type of access that you need in order to have them. But that's super in the weeds, way outside of my knowledge base. Title IX is an incredible thing, and it should be a thing. And so I think in these situations sometimes people look at it as like almost an advantage for women, and like, oh, it's so easy. And I'm like, we don't make any money doing sports. Like, we have almost zero opportunities. Like, this is a thing because we recognize we're at such a massive disadvantage in terms of access and opportunity that this was like forced upon universities because otherwise they would never do it. And so, yeah, I think it's a super interesting thing, and I really appreciate all the people who have fought make it happen and continue to make sure that universities both enforce their rules but then also don't use it as an excuse to cut things like men's track and field when it's just such an important part of their really athletic rosters.
Because and when was it introduced?
Title IX has been a thing now probably, I think it was introduced like in the 70s. I don't know the exact year, but I could actually look it up. Yeah. I probably should know.
Not too important the exact year. Because I guess the net effect if you're a university like Notre Dame or Duke or is that for a non-football male sponsored athlete, it's costing you twice because you're having to have a female. So actually, that's how they might see it, kind of financially, which is, really interesting. Oh, no, we're completely off piste as usual, but bring us into Atalanta then. So, like, what was the first kind of conversation about? What was the first idea?
Yeah, so really, I guess what had happened to instigate me wanting to build a team, is that back in probably fall of 2020, it became really clear that the state of track and field sponsorship was super rocky and is going to change for the long term, because it just, as it stands, doesn't really make any sense from a business perspective, right? And it's because, you know, for most brands outside of a few, the real kind of point of having sponsored athletes is to gain brand awareness and then hopefully sell some product, right? Like there's sometimes brands, and these typically tend to be the like more financially well-off ones, where it's more meant to be a marketing move to prove they have the best product because they have the most number of medals, stuff like that. But for most brands, it's really just about how can we, you know, kind of spread the word about the brand, how can we show that it's good and competitive and therefore sell some. And the kind of current model of traditional track sponsorship is where a shoe apparel brand pays an athlete through an independent contractor relationship to wear their stuff, run in their stuff. And occasionally, like maybe post about them, occasionally hop in an ad, but it's a very like not, like real thing. Like, you look at people's Instagrams and you're like, when are they ever posting about that brand, or when are they ever in an ad? Like, you know, you're watching TV all the time. Do you ever really see like professional track athletes used? It's super rare. So the thing is, now that our, you know, media has really evolved to be one in which social media is such an important piece of our day-to-day lives and what we do. And even things like this, things like podcasts, things like interviews, you know, anything that's kind of this digital online space is all of a sudden like not really being considered important within traditional track contracts. And so what happens is that these marketing groups within all of these brands are suddenly losing the same amount of like power and dollars that they used to be able to kind of like convince their bosses to give them, because their bosses are like, well, we could just go pay a social media influencer to do one really, really good social post, and it's probably going to achieve everything we want compared to paying the salary of an athlete who maybe has no media training and doesn't really post very often. And so, you know, at the end of 2020, it became really clear that a lot of athletes were going to be in trouble pretty soon. Luckily, a lot of people were able to extend their contracts through kind of these like 1-year deals. But it just seems like we're kind of like at this turning point where it's going to be harder to get a contract. There's going to be less money in sport, or at least our specific sport. And even if you're one of the lucky ones and you do get a deal, you're not really building career skills that are applicable to future jobs. And minus like 3 people, nobody's really getting set off for life. So you are going to at some point have to get another job. I would love to still be a pro runner when I'm 50, but I think we all know that's not really how these things work. So really long background of, I think, what I see as problems in the industry from a very, very business perspective, and not, I think, a lot of the more like social issues of how athletes are treated. But from a purely business perspective, it's a broken model and needs to change. And so I wanted to create something really similar to what I have as a relationship to the brand that I work for, Tracksmith, where I'm a full-time employee, I'm supported in running, I have a flexible role so that my training is supported, but I also have a day job. Like, I also actually like log in and answer emails and work. So when I create a resume, there's literal, you know, bullets that I can put down and things that I can explain and really take away that set me up for success long-term. And so I wanted to create something like that, that I could then pass on to other athletes, where they had more opportunities to run full time, have a steady salary, but also develop career skills and work so that they're, you know, supporting an organization. And that was like the first ever idea I had. It was like, how do I do that? And immediately I knew the only way I as an individual could ever see myself doing that is through a nonprofit. And the reason is because ever since I shared my New York Times piece in 2019, I've always wanted to be more engaged within the community service space and really help change the sport in a way that was super impactful. And a nonprofit was always the way I could foresee myself doing that. And so through Atalanta, I get to do both. I get to create a nonprofit that's actually doing community service work I believe in, but then I'm employing professional athletes who now are going to have the opportunity to not only run, but also develop career skills. And then, you know, cherry on top, give back to the community that, you know, they've fallen in love with and has given them so much.
So who is it then?
Who's in it?
Funds? Where does the money come? Yeah. Oh, apologies. Yeah. Where does the money come for it then?
Yeah. So that's part of the interesting thing too about creating something unique like this is, unlike traditional relationships between brands, which tend to just be like one funder of a team, we take a multi-funding approach. So there's 3 different parts to it. There's the first part, which is just traditional sponsors who want to come into the sport, love what we're doing, want to be a part of it. So our three founding sponsors are Tracksmith, Airbnb, and Noon. And we're currently talking to some other brands about kind of continuing to develop relationships really kind of across the sports world, and hopefully kind of continue to develop some like non-traditional sponsors. So that's one piece. Second piece is donors. So just people who love what we're doing, love the nonprofit side of things and the athlete side, and want to lend their support. And so we've had some really incredible relationships developed through the donor side. And so we're always, you know, telling people to reach out if they want to get involved.
Are they coming to you, or are you having to go out there and make the case for it? How you know, proactive do you need to be, or how proactive are they at wanting to be part of it?
I would say right now it's actually been 50-50.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's a lot of work on my end for sure. I think that, like, I'll never not be fundraising, because to me, I always want this to be bigger. I always want this to grow and be more stable. But I've definitely had people reach out to me through a variety of different ways, whether it's through our email, through my LinkedIn, you know, really it's kind of been a bunch of different ways. And then also part of the role of my board is to help kind of continue to develop relationships. So it's not just me, but it's also them kind of connecting me to people who they think might be interested in this. And then, you know, once you get one person, they send you to two more, and it kind of becomes this just like exponential growth of contacts.
And so a company like Airbnb, because there's not an obvious link between, I guess you go to races, you travel, but what type of things then? Are they giving it more as a, almost a donation to a good cause, or are there very kind of specific ways in which you're helping with their advertising and marketing?
Yeah, so Airbnb is actually an Olympic partner. So they're a USOPC partner, and they have actually a lot of really cool programs for athletes, so people should definitely check this out. But some of the stuff that they do is what are called experiences, or Olympic experiences in the case of sports, but they also have nonprofit experiences. So we're kind of like double dipping a little bit, if you will. But if you go either online, and then they sometimes offer these in person, they have all sorts of like classes, events, and, you know, it's kind of just this like diverse range of different things that you can sign up for. Mm. They can be travel related. They can be Olympic athlete related. There's some really cool ones, and we are hosting some different classes on the site, both through me as an individual and otherwise, that are all kind of around like our journey and like kind of appealing maybe towards athletes or people in business. And so part of the reason we're working with them is then there's this really direct connection within that nonprofit Olympic space, which they're trying to promote through their experiences. So they almost have more of like an already existing ecosystem for why they care about sports. And when I connected to their team, they were really supportive. And I think they recognized the fact that we were trying to do things differently. And I think very often, just through their relationships with athletes, they've kind of seen how this can really, really be beneficial to female runners. And so they've been super supportive.
And do you get, because my concern would be that, you know, you've got some amazing athletes, you've obviously got a high profile, and that a lot of the motivation will be, we'll fund it while it's getting the headlines for how great it is for, you know, how empowering it is to females, all those things. But have you got a sense whether this is like do you think that it will be as attractive in the long term?
Yes, I do. I mean, I think right now it's been interesting just to see the amount of support and positivity that we've had, not only nationally, but internationally. Like, there's already been people reaching out asking, like, how do we spread this into insert like multiple different countries? And the truth is, like, that is my goal. My goal is for this to be something that's really big and it's able to really change the model, you know, outside of just New York. But at the same time, we're 2 months in. So I'm very focused on, like, the here and now. And as a result, like, although I understand every single reason why this should grow, why this should continue, X, Y, and Z, I'm just focusing on today. And so I think that's been, like, a positive learning experience for my running as well. Because I think as athletes, it's so easy for us to get really far ahead of ourselves. And as CEO of an organization, like, it's such a similar, like, mindset to being an athlete, because there's this part of you that's supposed to be like, I dream big, let's go all the way. But then there's also that part of you is like, this is what I did today. Let's try to be a little better than tomorrow. Because if I think about what my goals are 5 years from now, that's a very far jump. And so, you know, right now I would say, like, our top priorities are we're finalizing, like, a small initial roster of athletes for the next, like, fall season. Part of it is that at the end of the year, a lot of traditional contracts end. And so we're hoping to, like, recruit some athletes at that point to kind of bolster the roster to a slightly larger size. But we always plan on kind of starting off a little smaller and purposeful with each of our hires. And then I'll always be fundraising. So if people ever want to reach out, I'm always here. That's kind of my, like, big thing that I'm always focused on. And then as a team, we're finalizing our plans for starting service programming in the fall.
And so how many athletes are you thinking then for this first year? And what are the big differences between how you're working with them and what you're committing to and what typically sponsors have done?
Yeah. So to start, there's going to be 4 or 5 just in the next, like, couple months. Want to see if we can kind of build that up to, like, 6 or 7 by the end of the year. But I think part of what makes our group different than a lot of other teams is there's a lot more that kind of goes into our almost interview process than maybe normal teams, because we're offering more. And so rather than really just having somebody be paid through a 1099 independent contractor relationship, athletes are full-time employees. So they're, like, truly a part of our organization. And as a result, there's not an agent cut of their full-time salary. So that traditional, like, 15% of agent fees is not being applied. And so, like, dollar for dollar, you're always kind of, like, really getting what you signed for, if you will. And so what our expectations of athletes are is that they're going to train to be the best that they can be. We're going to help them throughout that process by giving them, like, kind of top tier service here in New York City, getting to be trained by John Green, who's, you know, an Olympic medalist coach now after Molly's bronze. That was so fun to watch. And then they're also really kind of taking on 2 roles. One is a job kind of their choosing within the organization. It's going to be kind of personally designed for everybody so that it's really developing their own specific kind of long-term career goals. Because, you know, if somebody long-term wants to go into education, I'm not going to necessarily dump them with something that's, like, completely unrelated to that. And so it's been fun talking to each of our recruits about what they're most interested in doing. And every job is meant to be something not only they can really benefit from in the long term, but also super flexible, right? Like, we don't expect people to be logging in from these hours and, you know, filling out time cards every week. It's a little bit more like, if you're getting the work done, if you're kind of doing everything, I don't care if you're lying on the couch in compression boots while doing it. Like, you know, we're really trying to maximize our athletes' abilities to train and recover on their schedule and build work around it. And then the last piece of the puzzle is once a week doing training so that they're prepared for our service events, which will mostly be on the weekends, where they'll come into a city park for an hour and teach our mentorship programming to a small group of girls. And that's really kind of where the service piece comes in.
So does that mean then at the end of their running, well, their athletic career, they're all going to be, they'll then be fired, I guess, you'll have to, if they're full-time employees. I guess that's a joyful thing in some ways, but.
Yeah, so that's been part of our conversation as well with a lot of our different partners, whether on the sponsor side, donor side, or even just like the local community who's been getting involved, either through our training plans or reaching out to offer as volunteers, is, you know, that's not happening anytime soon, right? Like everybody's starting off is, you know, going to have like a long career ahead of them. And so we are very early on kind of planning next steps for a really smooth offboarding process. Because part of the whole goal of this organization is to give athletes the career skills to be set up better for their next step. And so we want to help them actually jump into that next step. We're not going to just be like, okay, bye, thanks. There's going to be a much more specific, like, you know, hopefully kind of, you know, opportunity to tap into our already existing partners and networks and say, okay, you've been like cheering this person on for the last 5 years working with them. What's kind of, you know, at play right now? What are things you're trying to problem solve for? How can we, you know, help develop this next step for them?
And have you thought about what you'd do if you have someone who's really lovely, who's an incredible athlete, but it turns out just utterly useless to everything else? And so in terms of the job they're doing for your organization, you know, they're someone who you'd hire immediately, but they may still be winning gold medals. What would happen in that circumstance?
I think, honestly, that's a lot of what's more happening now, in that we're in advance recruiting people, interviewing people to really make sure everybody knows what they're doing. Right? Because the truth is, like, you're not, like, that's not our goal. Our goal isn't just to have somebody who's an employee in name only and not really kind of believe in the ethos of the organization. And so part of our recruiting process takes longer than maybe your average team, because we want to really be smart about things and we want to make sure that's not an issue that we're ever really kind of coming up against. And so part of it means recruiting a little bit differently, like, and trying to find people who maybe your average team would overlook, right? Because maybe they're the person who was super, super talented, did an incredible job, but didn't come from one of the big five schools here in the US. Maybe they're an international athlete. Like, there's so many different ways that we can almost be looking at people that's not just going down the rosters of, you know, top teams and seeing who's their graduating senior, right? And honestly, that is sometimes what happens within these normal brands. Is it's a little bit more of like, okay, you won this one race, let me call you, versus like, where did they go to school? What was their major? What's been, you know, some of the criteria they've been looking for in teams? What are some of the questions that they're asking? So yeah, it's been, I think, fun building this, like, almost interview process for our program. And it's been going well. And I think right now we're really far along with, like, quite a few athletes, and we're not going to have any of those problems with them. I'll just tell you that.
and like, what is the balance then of your, when you're assessing, where are you putting the weighting of results in athletics versus everything else?
Mm-hmm. I think athletic results is kind of the first level, right? But again, we're maybe not just looking at, like, did you go to one of these three schools and run well? Like, we're looking at, like, the full breadth of results. And a lot of that's led by John Green, who's somebody who's always been incredible, not only as a coach, but as somebody who, like, develops athletes. Mm. And so, you know, still example, but sometimes we're trying to find out, like, how much is somebody running? Like, are they already running 80 miles a week? Or are they somebody who did incredibly well off of, like, 30 to 40 miles a week? Mm. And sometimes it's like kind of like first just getting a base sense of, like, what are their athletic accomplishments, but then kind of diving in to see, okay, like how much room do we have for growth and to build them and to develop them as an athlete? And also how much, you know, openness do they have to the idea of balancing mentorship and a part-time, you know, kind of hours level of position with all of their training? And the truth is, I think it's been interesting because, like, we're starting to notice trends where it's like, it's often the person who maybe wasn't dreaming since their, you know, middle school cross country race to become pro. It's kind of the person who's like, hey, I actually haven't run like that many miles for that long, but I've done really, really well. And I want to see where else I can go. But this current model doesn't seem like the sort of place that wants me in it. And that's the person who are like, we want you.
So I guess the unpolished gems.
Yeah, exactly. And I think part of it for me is that, like, I do look at how we kind of currently, like, give people contracts. And it is very, like, you ran this time, you got this place. And it's also, you look this certain way, you went to this certain school, you know this person, so they were able to hook you up. Like, they're, you know, for all the pomp and circumstance that a lot of these brands make about the fact that it's all about time, it's all about place, really not. There's a lot of, like, not so great metrics that are used to kind of select why somebody gets an opportunity and somebody else doesn't. And I think one of the criteria is this, like, are you going to sacrifice everything for running? Are you going to, you know, pick up and move all the way across the country to insert town that like 12 people live in and 11 of them outside of yourself are also runners and never kind of like develop yourself as a person outside of it? And of course, not every team does this, but I think in this bigger picture sense, I don't think that like develops the best athletes. Because instead, I think that fosters a ton of burnout. It's kind of like, you know, for every 10 talented people, one does well, versus if you take a holistic approach, maybe six or seven of them would do well, which to me seems more like a win. And so, yeah, I think we're almost in this really exciting place where, like, a lot of the people who we've been talking to are actually people who reached out to us. Because they heard what we were doing, they were excited about this model, and they came to us explaining why they saw this is better. And, you know, that's been a lot of fun. And some of those people are people who are hoping to kind of bring on in the beginning of next year, early January. And some of them are kind of big names within the running world and people who've been around for a little while, but they can look at the current way things are set up and know it's not really developing them as an athlete or a person.
And you mentioned how they're going to have jobs in the organization, ideally matching where they want to go and matching their skills. Can you give some examples of that? Just because that feels like an incredibly hard thing to do within an organization to find a purpose for everyone given that 50% of jobs in companies are the ones that suck balls. And so it's like, how do you find people? So yeah, what's everyone doing so far?
Yeah. So like example is that like, you know, we've had a few people who maybe have like an English writing background, right? And so within our company, like there's so much written work that we have to do, whether it's, you know, email communications with our different newsletters, copy editing any of our social media posts, or, you know, even kind of like basic things where like creating docs and decks that we can then share with prospective donors and sponsors, you know, that's a lot of time writing. And you'll see all three of the things that I listed are kind of within very different, like traditional company verticals, right? You're gaining social media experience, you're gaining like kind of donor sponsor liaison experience, and you're also developing marketing experiences through those newsletters. And so how we're kind of trying to look at things is we want to be able to kind of build like roles and jobs by kind of finding what somebody's like core competency is, the thing they really want to develop, and then finding ways to give them as many opportunities as in many different spaces as possible, so that a year from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, whenever, whether within our organization or outside of it, they can say, like, I love doing social media, or I love doing sponsorship work, or when I have to write like educational kind of programming to share with kids, I get a lot of joy out of it while I'm not getting the same fulfillment out of social media. Like, whatever it is, I think the more we can let people dabble and then decide, the better set up they are. So that's one example. We have people in educational backgrounds who want to be kind of really involved in like building the programming, connecting with some of our partners to develop it. So there's a lot of different things that we kind of have, but I would say we're a little lucky right now where a lot of them don't overlap.
And I think that would be probably the bigger challenge is scaling that, where naturally people were drawn to some skills or have there's an amount of some skills more than others, and how you then have an organization that could potentially be heavily weighted towards some. Were you happy to go back to the beginning then to kind of explain your journey and why, how this has kind of come about?
Yeah, sure thing.
Because when did you mentioned how, you know, your dad was doing some Googling. Like, when did you first realize you were pretty kick-ass?
I think there's like, you know, there's all of the naive moments before the legitimate moment, right? Mm. So I think all the naive moments were like before I was the number one girl in the country as a freshman in high school in the 1500, right? Like, that was the moment where I suddenly really was like, oh, all of those years of like naiveness ended up being real, right? But before then, like in kindergarten, I was, you know, one of the fastest kids. And so I was like, yeah, I'm a great runner. Like, I'm the fastest girl. And then by third grade, I was the fastest kid in the grade. And then by fifth grade, I ran a 6:10 mile. So there were these milestones where I like was not a runner. Like, I did no running. These were like gym class things where I ran. And in those gym class moments, I'd be like, yeah, I'm going to the Olympics. Not a big deal. In my head. But in retrospect, like, you were one of like hundreds of people to do that, right? And so it probably wasn't until my freshman year in high school that I suddenly realized that I was truly like a nationally ranked athlete, best girl in the 1500. I think I finished the season off with like 4:17. That ranked me number one, was number two under 19, came in second at like our US junior champs. And that was kind of the moment where I was like, ooh, I could like go to NXN. I could go to World Juniors. Like, I could get free stuff at cool meets, right? And so that was the moment I maybe thought I was like good in that way. But it probably wasn't until my like junior year that I started competing against pros that I really understood the magnitude of like what good in high school was versus what internationally competitive was.
And so when you were at high school and younger then, like how much were you running, and, you know, what was your motivation, and what was your family unit like towards that? And, you know, were they sporty, and what was that experience like?
Yeah. So I didn't run until I was a seventh grader. Like, I ran like the end of year week long, you know, you're doing the high jump also, like, thing for an hour after school, and then I ran in gym class, right? So it was very much there's no real running happening here, there's no training, but like we go and we get milkshakes afterwards. I grew up a competitive swimmer. That was my primary sport. That was the one that I like really trained for and like competed in. But my parents are not sporty people. Like, we did not grow up really watching any sports other than like the Olympics and soccer. I come from a family of all girls. And so like we weren't, you know, maybe limiting our dream capacity by watching all men's sports and feeling like we had no opportunities in them. Mm-hmm. But instead we're watching like very like pro women athletes compete. And like, so I always just felt I could dream big. but in an incredibly zero pressure sort of way, because my parents just didn't know what they were doing and wanted to come to track meets in random places so that they could try the local like burger place, right? and so like they were super supportive. They did everything they could to, you know, help me, cheer me on, you know, came to all my meets sort of thing, but like very naive to the sport, which I always look back on as both beautiful because it meant it was always coming from within. To this day, I'm still in the sport because I wanted to be, not my parents. But I think it's also something that's tough because we maybe didn't know a lot about the sport. We like weren't prepared for like not great people being in sport also. And so that's, you know, I think how I define those kind of years as elementary school, middle school, or high school. Yeah.
So high school, did people care, like in the high school, were you walking around with a little bit of a, you know, kick in your step, or was it not really like that?
So I grew up in a really small town. I was in a school where it was K through 12. So for 13 years, I was in school with the same people. There were about 100 of us per grade. You know, your friend group was like very defined by the time you were a fifth grader. And so I was with the very academically based crew, and they're still my friends to this day. I was very lucky to have like a really great group of people that I was friends with. But we were not the athlete group. Like none of us did. I did running, and I swam, and I did other sports growing up, but that was kind of like weird that I did that. And so, no, I think I was in this very lucky situation, at least for my personal friends, that like nobody, when I went pro and like told them, they didn't even know that I could have gone and ran in the NCAA for track. Like that was who I was friends with. My other, like maybe other people within the school who are athletically based, I think people recognized how well I was doing. But I do think there was, you know, an air of competitiveness because, you know, I come from a very like wealthy suburb of New York City. We're all white. Like, you know, when we're talking about the people who are trying to use niche NCAA sports to get into college, I'm subtweeting them. And so I think there was never like maybe this like rah-rah go Mary school spirit. It was a little bit more like Mary's, you know, maybe taking our spot, even though I didn't even go to the NCAA.
And
so it was like a mix of good and bad.
And what kind of like how many hours a week would you say you were training at that at kind of a 12 to 15 and then at a high school as well?
Oh, like barely anything. I mean, when I was like in middle school, I during most of the year was probably swimming like 6 hours a week. So I'd probably go to like 3 2-hour practices, like 40 weeks of the year, 35 weeks of the year. So like a good chunk of the year. And then running, it was like, I look back and I'm like, oh, I didn't run. Like I was probably running like 15 miles a week in middle school. And even early high school, when I got kind of serious, like probably sophomore year, I probably peaked at like 30 miles. Like it wasn't very much. Especially because you look back and you're like, oh, I thought I was probably running 6 minute miles every run. This was probably 10 minute pace. But yeah, it was very minimal mileage. And then junior, senior year, I think I probably would like max out at like 65. So it was a pretty big jump. But for most of the year, I was probably running between like 45 and 50. So my high school years, I was never a high mileage person, but I would have these random weeks that I look back on where I'd be like, what was I doing? Why did I run 70 miles that week?
You
also look back, and I didn't have a GPS watch, so I always overestimated also how much I ran. Because I look back at those courses, and I'm like, Mary, that field was not a mile. That field was probably like 1,000 meters.
I mean, I think that's really useful for any parents to know, you know, the level you're at without having to do crazy mileage. And I think there is now almost a pressure and an expectation that to be at the top, you've got to be flogging yourself for years. But it's good to see that wasn't the case. So you got a scholarship then to college.
I didn't get an athletic scholarship, no, because I forego my NCAA eligibility by signing a professional contract, which here in the States means you can't compete for a college team. But I still went to college. I just wasn't, like, it wasn't an athletic scholarship that I was on.
Oh, so you had an academic scholarship?
I mean, I did, like, yeah.
You're not also like grade 8 in the oboe and the saxophone, and you could have got that as well. And so how did how was that decision made then? Because that seems to be quite unusual, I'd have thought. I mean, is it?
Mm-hmm. Yep. It definitely is. At least here in the U.S. At the time when I made the decision, you guys will appreciate this, because I would look at a lot of international athletes. And because they don't have an NCAA system, you know, you totally can go and compete for your university team. But like in Britain, for example, I had competed at a World Juniors with Jess Judd. And she was just like a couple years older than me. And I remember when she went pro, like that was just normal. It was just like, yeah, you're a really good young athlete. That's what you do. But in the States, you know, not many people had done that before me. There was Ajay Wilson, Alpha Felix, but it was definitely a unique thing to do at the time, especially when I did, which was like early on in my senior year of high school.
And does that happen only, was that because the sponsors approached you then?
Yeah, I mean, at that point, I had competed at my first like world championship and come in 10th. And so it just felt like from a progression, you know, it wouldn't make sense for me to not take the opportunity to continue to compete against pros and also get paid for it. And then just continue in my mind to do college almost like I was doing high school, right? Where it's like in high school, I was just friends with the academically paced people. It wasn't like I was friends with the track team. And so to me, it just seemed like I was going to kind of just like the next progression would be to just be friends with the school kids and then, you know, almost run on the side like I'd always been doing.
And so then, why are you not allowed to do both then? Is that, why do you think what the motivation is that to protect, I guess, is it to stop athletes all just doing constant degrees and being pro at the same time, or?
No, it's all about money in the NCAA. Like NCAA is all about money. That's all they care about. If there's one random like fact point that you walk away from this being like, what's Mary's opinion on? NCAA is all about money. And so the reason you're not traditionally, there's been some recent changes within the last like kind of 6 months to a year around the NCAA, but you can't sign a traditional like shoe apparel sponsorship because the idea is that you're then at an advantage and they have all hosts of reasons why you're not allowed to do that, and it affects your amateurism, and so they like maintain this really strong line of what's an amateur, what's a professional. But recently there have been some like legal changes that have made it so that student athletes will have the ability to accept some forms of money, but not necessarily. It's still not like fully clear if what I had done as a senior in high school would have like let me stay eligible to compete for a college team. That level of like signing a contract with Nike probably still isn't fully kosher.
Okay, because so does that mean just because in fact I did, I think I did a friend of mine, Bob, made this documentary about American football players not getting any cash and then them being injured and their lives being ruined. Yeah. And so does that change, do you think, looking at this last Olympics, would it have an impact on who competes for America? Or is it just accepted that you don't get money from it while you're at college, but you still compete for your country?
Yeah, so traditionally, like up until recently, there was a very, very strong line of like college athletes can't get paid, pros can get paid. So if you wanted to compete for your college, you didn't get paid. And the truth is, a college education, if you're getting a full ride, I mean, that can be like $60,000 a year that you're not spending, right? So it's not that you're making that, but like you kind of are. And it's really hard to get contracts that are over that level of financial support. So usually if you're kind of looking at like the dollar for dollar opportunity, it just doesn't really make sense for somebody to go pro. And so that's why a lot of people stay in the NCAA. And so, if you're a pro, you obviously are usually a little older and maybe have a little bit more opportunities because you get more things are paid for, you have, financial support. But if you're a college athlete, you still get a lot of perks. So when you're looking at the Olympics, it's not rare to see college athletes competing because they're sort of treated like pros. They're just not paid to do it. Similarly in football, like you look at those college kids in the US here and like they're training so intensely and they're just not being paid for it. They're just being paid through scholarship. Now there have been recent changes so that athletes will be able to start taking like certain forms of sponsorship. I don't think it's this like all-inclusive, like everything's go now. I think there's like still certain restrictions. I haven't been following closely enough to know explicitly, but I do think it's going to create a lot of changes within the NCAA. Some really good, some super, super positive, others highly problematic. The positive is going to be that, like, as you were saying, some of those football players, bigger money sport kids who've kind of just been screwed for the last forever, because if you don't go pro, you're kind of left sometimes hurt, sometimes not supported, sometimes even without like a real college degree that you can use. They're suddenly going to have a little bit more say and a little bit more power. But I think there's also going to be the negative effects of some programs are going to get so much better than everybody else because maybe their boosters, their donors, their supporters are just going to shell out and like find ways to pay people so that it does become a bit of like a, again, what I was saying earlier when I'm talking about recruiting athletes, like there might become like three teams in college that are really, really good that you just, if you want any money, if you want any support, you got to be on them. And personally, I think that's problematic when you're trying to develop Olympic level talent because it means, like what's gonna start to happen is I just shared with you guys my mileage when I was young. Nowadays, when you have Strava, social media, all the things I didn't have in high school, kids are going to be training like 80 miles a week so that they can get into that best program so that they can have the opportunities to go pro. That kid isn't necessarily better, more talented than the kid who's running 30 miles a week and maybe 5, 6 seconds slower than them, but who doesn't get into that top program. And therefore, we just never really see again, even though maybe they are being smarter, maybe they are being healthier, maybe they are like apples to apples more talented long term. But we're going to have this issue where we're just seeing kids, I think, kind of cramming. And I just don't know if that's really the best way to develop talent.
Yeah, I mean it's forcing development at certain ages as well, which in development's not linear.
No.
And so for you then, was it because you wanted the support of Nike, or was that just because you thought might as well take the money?
At the time, I was already working with Alberto Salazar, right? I was already connected kind of within the Nike system. And so it just was like a natural next step, right? Where you're like, I'm 10th in the world, like, let me try to be 9th next year, right? You know what I mean? And it felt the best way to do that was to, like, train with people who were already number one, number two, number three in the world. And so that was why I went pro, was really just from my, like, athletic development. It just, like, that seemed like the next step. And so I still believe that it should have been the right next step. But unfortunately, the team that I was a part of really maybe didn't value that same long-term growth, health of the athlete, mental health, conversations that we're kind of talking about now that I do really value, and instead, you know, saw a talented young athlete and kind of imposed this win-at-all-cost culture onto them. And yeah, it was a really difficult time in my life, and one that I really wish upon no one. And so it's been the driving force for me for why I'm creating the programming and opportunities for other athletes, you know, including myself, that I am. And it's to kind of, you know, make sure that maybe doesn't happen again, or I protect a few people from ever getting in that situation.
And how quickly did it kind of turn then, in terms of, you know, when did you kind of realize this isn't going the way I was hoping it was going to go? Or, you know, was it relatively quickly, or was there a honeymoon period?
No, unfortunately, it was super fast.
Oh, really?
So what happened was, like, how I, you know, say it is that March 2014 was my senior year, and I won U.S. Indoor Championships. I ran a 407 indoor at altitude. It was a really strong performance, and I was supposed to race at World Indoors. But the day after the race, I woke up and my shin hurt. Turns out I had developed stress reaction in my shin, and I made the decision personally to pull out of World, because even though they were kind of trying to get me to run through it, I was just like, this is super painful. I can't do it. I have to shut down. Yeah.
And is they Nike, or is they Salazar, or is they, you know,
the Nike Oregon project?
Okay. And before we kind of, do you mind if we go back a bit, actually, just to talk about how you, because I still don't really understand how your involvement works, like, when, because you're college, right, and you're still with Nike. Are you on the college campus the whole time? Have you moved to Nike? Are you coaching locally?
So I started working with Alberto my junior year of high school, and I was still in New York for 2 years. And I had a local coach here, John Henwood, who really kind of like was my coach 90% of the time and like kind of on the ground with me. But I had a super close relationship with Alberto. Like, we texted all the time, emailed all the time, called all the time. And then whenever I traveled, I was with him and the NOP team. So when this injury happened, I was a senior in high school. So I still lived at home. Like, I still was here in New York versus in Portland. But I was, at this point, already a paid Nike athlete, already like kind of full-fledged Oregon Project teammate, even though I was a 17-year-old senior in high school. So when I shut things down, I like moved home, and I, you know, maybe cross-trained for like a month or whatever the exact timeline was. And long story short, I think that was the moment where my body was suddenly like, hey, like, you're an 17-year-old woman, like, we're going to start developing a little bit. And it was super subtle changes. Like, I didn't notice them as an individual, but like, I think my body was starting to reach that point where like, it wanted me to like pay attention to itself, right? Like, eat a little better, and like, you know, almost like eat a little more probably. And ever like all the years before that, I never had any sort of stuff with food, right? I had my milkshakes, I had my burgers, I had like a really well-rounded good diet, because I did not grow up in an athletic family. We just ate like your normal American diet, I guess. And I kept doing that, and conversations about weight started happening, where it was subtle at first, and then it really kind of ramped up in intensity. where I ended up that June rebounding really great from that injury, still coming in second at the U.S. Championships. I qualified for World Juniors, and I ended up winning World Juniors. Really, really good. All very impressive stuff, if I do say so myself. But the reason I'm kind of referring to it as such is because I kept being told I wasn't allowed to go to Europe that summer because I wasn't in good enough shape. And I was like, what are you talking about? I'm like number two in the U.S., like just won World Juniors. I'm ready to run that. And like I was told that I was too fat to be competitive if I raced in Europe. And so rather than move to college in like late August, like I had initially planned, we fast tracked me moving to Portland so that I could lose weight. And this was not told to my parents. This was just a conversation with me. And I like kind of dove into it and was like, okay, you're the best coach in the world. I guess I'm supposed to do this. And things very, very quickly started to escalate once I moved out there.
And before that, then, do you think, so was that based on a number, do you think? Or was he wanting you to have a body shape? Or were you doing tests on kind of?
I think that's part of the thing that's like tough, is that it was a mix of him wanting me to look like certain people and also him kind of picking an arbitrary number that he just made up because like there's no such thing as an ideal weight. So like there was no math, there was no talking to doctors, there was no talking to professionals. It was just, I want you to look like this person, weigh 112 to 114 pounds. And at the time I was 118 pounds. So I wasn't exactly like miles away from it. And 118 pounds in retrospect was like was probably too small for my developing body at the time. And so I, like any good athlete, committed, bought in, did what I was supposed to do. And at first found success losing weight. I did get down to that weight zone for probably like a month. Felt horrible the whole time, did not feel good. And then just like didn't change anything I did with the dieting that I was doing, but I just started creeping back up in number. And it was weird, right? Because I'm a academically based kid. I know how to, you know, count things. I was doing everything they told me, like counting calories, not eating certain foods, you know, really kind of just trying to do it. And my body was just like, nope, we're going to always be like a really frustrating 3 to 4 pounds heavier than that. And
do you remember what kind of what rules you were following or what calorie number you were trying to hit, or like if there are any things that you was it just that the number was too small of calories or?
Yeah. So Alberto always told me that a calorie is 35 a pound is 3,500 calories. And so if I could cut that amount from my like energy numbers every week, I would lose a pound. And so I tried to cut 500 calories to 1,000 calories of food every day so that I could lose a pound a week. This, by the way, to anybody listening, do not be inspired by this. If you are a competitive runner, you do not need to be doing this. You should never be counting calories. This is like every single thing that registered dietitians, who are people who are professionals in this field, will tell you don't do as an athlete. And so I was doing that. I was trying to eat about 1,500 calories a day. And, you know, I would like Google what different things added up to, and I would, you know, do the math, and there'd be days where I like just ate an apple for dinner. Or I like was really big with like drinking tea a lot so that I would feel full. It was horrifying looking back on like how much I just did what I was told to do. But without any like resources, without like any professional observing me, without anybody else doing the math for me. Like, I was told the calories I should eat. I was told how much I had to lose. And I really did my best. And the truth is, it was exhausting. It was time consuming. I was miserable doing it. I just felt tired and hungry all the time. You know, like going, doing that, makes it so that you literally have less energy to like live your life, right? Mm. And so a lot of the mental health things that I went through in retrospect, it's a no-brainer. Like, of course that's going to happen when you're under eating to that degree, because if you're literally just eating enough to let you survive on the day to day, then how are you going to like have enough energy to suppress your emotions when you're sad, or to like kind of be positive? Like, you're just trying to survive. And I'm only laughing because I think it's stuff like this. It's like, you either laugh or you cry at this point. Right. And it's so sad to look back on, because it was just such like purposeful, like cruelty, like purposely trying to like crush me down. And there would just be times where it'd be like, I would be like 3 or 4 pounds over, and I would just be told, you're not doing enough. What are you doing? Like, what are you eating? Like, are you still eating cookies? I'd be like, no. Yeah. And so it was just, it was horrible. But I think in those moments, and I'm sure anybody who's ever, you know, maybe had a dream that's really big, that's really scary, that's really beautiful will understand this, is that it was horrible during it. And I knew it was like horrible in this abstract way, but I thought it was bad because I wasn't tough enough. I thought it was bad because I wasn't strong enough. I wasn't like, I hated my body because I thought, you know, clearly other people, other girls can do this and I can't. And so it was this very like negative experience, but negative internally, because I was told through everything around me that the people who I was working with were the best and the brightest. And so anything you said should be good, true. And when I was dealing with it, it just felt like I was a failure versus this whole experience is terrible and I should never be in it and doing it. And so, you know, I think looking back on it, it makes me want to like help younger people learn how to have the confidence in themselves from a younger age, that they almost don't ever look at the Alberto Salazars of the world and feed into the, you know, kind of people around them, whether it's the Nikes or the teammates or stuff like that, telling them that they're bad, you know? And I think that is so much of what my story was just for years believing them, and for years believing I was the failure, I was the problem, because I couldn't starve myself well enough.
And do you think it would, because you've used the word cruelty, do you think it was, he had cruel intent, or do you think that it was more that he had a set of rules in his head that had to be adhered to, and the effect of trying to enforce you to adhere to those was cruel? Like, would you say, I mean, do you see there's a slight difference in that? Like,
yep. No, I totally understand what the question you're asking. And the answer is, I do believe that it was intended to be cruel. And the reason is I don't, in my heart of heart, think that anybody who wasn't trying to be cruel wouldn't have intervened in a lot of very, very big moments where I was really asking for help. And I don't know, was the end game for me to just look like other girls that he wanted me to look like? I don't know if it was for me to really reach a weight. I don't know if this was all just a test to see how much I was willing to buy into the system and how well I followed rules. I have no idea why they were so cruel, but I do believe this was a purposeful, like, testing process. Because I think, like, how I just look at these things, right, is that we've all made mistakes. We've all done things that we look back on and we're like, oh, that comment probably really hurt that person, or that comment was probably out of place and I didn't mean it that way, right? Like, we've all done that. But I think what people who did it by accident will do is, one, apologize, two, like, in the moment, like, really make sure the person's okay, and then three, try their best to never do it again. And I think all three of those steps repeatedly in the time and repeatedly to this day haven't happened. And that's why it's hard for me to see it as anything other than just cruel.
And that's really interesting, because Chrissy Wellington, when we were interviewing her, one of the areas that we went into quite detail, which we weren't expecting to, was with her coach and how he almost fostered hostility within the women of the group against each other to try and encourage competitiveness. Was that part of it as well, or?
Yeah, that's so, I mean, I'm sorry that she went through that too, but it's something that's so, like, sad to look back on, like, how much the women were pitted against each other in ways where you're just like, it wasn't done to the men, you know, like, there wasn't that same, like, you know, just example is like, hey, you know, she was saying this about you, like, I don't think she likes you, you know, you're kind of a crybaby at practice, like, you know, like, you should avoid her. And then you'd go to practice and be like, oh my God, she hates me. Like, this is super weird. Like, what am I doing? And God knows what was being said to the other girl. But over the years, when you talk to the guys of that team, that was that, like, kind of petty fostering of rivalry was never a thing. But I know back when Kara and Amy were on the team, it was. And I know when I was on the team, it was. And I think that, like, very purposefully gendered creation of combativeness is just so toxic. And again, it's a moment where you're like, okay, if that was almost accidental, shouldn't it have happened to the guys too? Shouldn't it have not just been the women's team that happened to? And at the end, those moments where you start to look at it and you're like, this feels like a very purposeful moment to try to weed out who they want.
And so, do you think it's just it's a misplaced sense of, this is how we get the best out of them, and it's just either they've done, that's what they've always done, and so that's what they're doing, or something else?
You know, like, I think you would almost, I almost hope so. But I would be lying if it just didn't feel like there was a little bit of, like, wanting to watch a cat fight sometimes, you know? And I think that's what makes me sometimes a little, like, grossed out by the whole thing, is this feeling, like, of, like, why was it women? Like, why do you think women need that but men don't? Because, again, if you kind of think, like, oh, this is why you're tumping people up, this is what you got to do, like, wouldn't you also do that to the men?
Yeah.
And if the answer is no, it starts to be like, well, why just women? And you're kind of like, is it because we're women and you want that? Like, you know, and again, I think a lot of this is just like, there's so many moments as a female athlete where there's like these undercurrents of sport, right? Where I think almost to like, help us just get through our days, we have to shut out, right? It's like when you're catcalled on a run, when you're, you know, see people on Twitter writing about women athletes looking a certain way, or the way they dress, or the way they talk, you know, it's it's so, like, unfortunately just a part of being a woman that I think sometimes people almost excuse their guts and say, yeah, in the moment it felt like it was something kind of sexual, but if I really stop and think about that day to day, I'm probably just going to break down and be like, why am I here? What am I doing? You know? But I think unless we really acknowledge that, like, yeah, this happens to women and it's probably for really bad, dark reasons, nothing's going to change. And so even though it's like, you almost feel gross admitting it. Yeah. I think there was something like even darker about it happening to women.
And did you speak to Nike, for example, or when did you leave and how did you leave and were there any points along that journey that you think there was a chance in which it could have been a happy ending?
Yeah, I mean, I think my ending, by the way, is not that. You know, I'll first off just say that, and that, like, I think I'm having a happy ending. Like, no matter what I do in life, like, I've built a really great world around me, and whether my competitive career takes off in the ways that I dream or train for is almost like irrespective of like what my ending will be. Because I think, you know, I look at a lot of athletes and I'm like, if you think your happy ending is your Olympic gold medal, God, you got a lot of years to live after that. Like, there's a lot of moments to come. But I think in the case of my experience, you know, it's tough because a lot of the people who were a part of the Nike sports marketing department had incredibly close ties to what was going on. And it was, you know, whether it's like somebody's husband, you know, just the fact that like the Oregon Project cubicles were up in that part of the building, the fact that they were at some of the practices and like kind of witnessed some of the stuff happening at some of the meets, witnessing some of the stuff happening, you know, when you're 25 versus 18, you have the just knowledge of that time and that age and maybe that maturity to look back at some of that stuff and just say, God, if I saw that happening to somebody, I'd immediately intervene. Like, I would never let that girl walk away. I would never tell her, like, pick yourself up, don't cry, and like shove her over to the cool down track. You know, like that sort of stuff is just so bad. And I would always make it known that you had a safe space to go to. But the truth is, I didn't, because it was all so intertwined and incestuous and connected and witnessed and like a part of it. And, you know, it was also such a small world that like people talk, you'd get statements would be made where you'd be like, oh my God, they must have heard about that incident. And it just, you know, it's so, I think, when Naomi Osaka, long story short, came out and said she wasn't going to play in those majors, and people responded so negatively to her and were like, why didn't you go to them first? Like, why didn't you talk it out? You know, I just immediately was like, I get it, girl. Like, I totally understand. And it's because unless you're in these worlds, you do not know how small they are. And you do not know how much an athlete can just say, like, they were there, they saw it, I've asked, it never happened. And even if it wasn't this like grand decree on like, you know, beautiful calligraphy piece of paper, like, you know, I think often people are quick to defend billion-dollar organizations that they're fans of before kind of maybe believe an athlete when they say things were really bad. Yeah, I think this summer at least was very positive with like a lot of particularly women athletes standing up and saying like, we're not going to condone this sort of treatment.
But and you mentioned how, you know, how public it was, some of the training sessions and the people in the marketing team, partners. When this was happening, could you could you see in their eyes that they knew? Because there's two things there. It could be that it's just accepted that this is how things work, and everyone was like, yeah, Alberto's doing his thing. Or could you tell from the look in people's eyes that there was that genuine, like, regrets and horror at the time? It's just that the power structures meant that they were accepting what they knew was wrong.
Yeah, I guess that's hard to know, because I think in the moment, again, you're not, like, you know, through my eyes, I'm not seeing anything as bad that they're doing, right? I'm only seeing myself as bad and wrong and messed up and, you know, all the things they told me. Like, I was told almost every day at practice that I was a head case. And my God, I believed it. And I, like, let that really fully sink into me. And I think, like, I let them make me one, because I let that voice constantly rattle around in my head. And so that's to say that, like, when you're in an abusive environment, one of the scariest things is it's sometimes almost hard to know you're in one. And that's the reason people often take years to come out and share their stories. And it's because in the moment, abusers are so good with making you feel like you're the problem. And so I wasn't even necessarily, like, looking at, like, people's reactions and all that sort of stuff. I was just so focused on, like, getting through the day to day and trying to be better for them. And now that I look back, it's more me being able to say, oh my God, I'm an adult now. I would never watch a 17-year-old go through that and not intervene. What sort of person would not do that? And the truth is, there have been, like, a, you know, at least one old teammate of mine say he's sorry that he didn't, and say, I really should have. And I will say, like, Sam saying that to me has meant the world, because he's the only person who has. And so when somebody's able to say, I'm sorry, it makes me say, okay, like, that was just somebody else who was scared in the moment. That was somebody else who didn't know what they were doing. And so maybe some people were like that too. But, you know, that's all I've so far kind of heard from anybody, is either, no, it was her fault, you know, she's just an emotional wreck, which, by the way, even if somebody came into the situation with mental health problems, like, shouldn't they have not abused them? Like, it's like, whether or not this is something that's an underlying condition, you're like, oh, you're going to explain away abuse because somebody had depression? Like, that doesn't, to me, that doesn't actually make any logical sense. But beyond that, of those people, one person has said they are sorry.
And why do you think they haven't?
I don't know. Like, I think, you know, like, admission of guilt is always part of it, at least for some people. You know, and I think that's cowardly. And I'm sure there's a whole host of reasons. I mean, you guys follow the sport. You've seen the other drama that the Nike org and Nike teams get into, right? Like, I can't speak to that stuff because I was so living my own, like, worst nightmare that I don't think I was fully, like, engaged enough to even see some of that other, like, underbelly of drug use and all that sort of stuff. Like, all I know is I said no to everything I was offered, and who knows, maybe had I been more aware of people's reactions, I would have realized they were all getting pissed off or something. But in the time, you're just trying to survive. And so looking back, like, what their why is, I don't know. And I think the scary thing is there's probably a lot of reasons why they haven't said sorry. And, you know, it almost probably doesn't do any of us good, like, wondering. It's just, for me, a yes or no. You've either said it and you own it, or you didn't.
And you mentioned about, you know, the other potential allegations, well, the allegations against Salazar and Nike. I mean, were you offered anything unusual? Were there any incidents where you thought, this doesn't on paper seem to be what I believe is our, you know, athletes should be fueling as such?
Yeah, so I'll say, like, when I was on the team, I felt a lot of the stuff that I, like, went through as it pertains to medication tended to be stuff where I'm like, wow, you're really not taking into account an athlete's health, right? So, like, some of the stuff for me was I was, like, heavily encouraged to go on birth control pills. And the whole idea was so that I would lose weight. And I was sent into, like, Roberto, doctor's friends at the Times office. He came into the office with me. He told them that I was having trouble losing weight, and he thought that birth control would help me. So he asked for us to get some pills. I was sent out of the doctor's office with prescription sample birth control pills, and I never took them because, to me, birth control pills are, like, never performance enhancing, or at least not that I've ever been able to see. But, like, that was really wrong and really not okay and not a reason that I should ever go on birth control. Since then, Alberto has made statements saying he tried to have me go on birth control so I could get my period back, which wasn't true. It was just so that I could lose weight. And so to me, I'm like, why would, like, yes, maybe you would lie because you were embarrassed about this pseudoscience that never existed. But, like, even just lying afterwards about a situation that was just so bizarre in the time, I just, again, find confusing, right? And so was that an example of a test to see what I was willing to take? I don't know. But I guess I failed the test because I said no. And any time there was, like, weird, like, hey, you should get your breathing checked out, you clearly have asthma problems because you're breathing heavy, or hey, you should get your thyroid checked or anything like that, you know, very often afterwards, I would be told, hey, your numbers are in, like, the good level, but they're still kind of low, maybe you should take something. And I would just say no. I'd be like, I'm in the normal levels, I'm not going to take anything. And, you know, every time I was 16, 17, 18, I was very young, but I have always been interested in medicine. I was pre-med in school. And so, you know, overstepping anything medically just seemed wrong. And so, you know, there were times where I was, like, told, like, hey, you should take this inhaler. And I'd be like, nope, I think I'm okay. I don't have asthma. I don't think I need, like, allergy shots, or I don't think I need thyroid. And so, you know, all of those stories are just me saying no to things that just I didn't need. And, you know, maybe there would be follow-ups. Maybe there would be, hey, you know, I really do think you should take this. Like, nope. I'm a, you know, 17-year-old who's over peppy and just keeps saying no. And so that was kind of the extent for me. And did I have concerns about people on the team? Yes. And I voiced them to the coaches, and I voiced them to some of my teammates. And that was often met kind of negatively. And I didn't think that, you know, because, again, I'm in this bubble, I almost thought it was like, hey, this person travels a lot. Like, do you really know what they're doing when they're not around you? Versus this feeling of it, like, coming from our team. And I think it's just because I was super trusting. I was super young. I was, quote unquote, living the dream. And so anything I say beyond my own experience and the own kind of, like, feelings I had, thoughts I had, reactions I had would be purely conjecture, right? And I think that's unfair to any athlete who's on that team. I think that's unfair to the team itself, which is why I normally only ever talk about my own story. But the answer is, yeah, there were things that happened where, like, I said no because I didn't think it was right. And so nothing happened. But when the kind of full USADA report came out, I was able to read all of the moments where, you know, there were some of these stories that came out in the USADA report that I was told about, but just told a very different story, right? It'd be like, yeah, we did the thyroid or the L-carnitine stuff, but we got USADA's permission, right? And that's such a bold face, like, you know, a thing that I was just like, yeah, okay. If USADA has never done anything, then like he must have gotten USADA's permission. And then when you're reading the report, it'll be like, nah, there was no permission. That was never a thing. Mm. And it was literally reading stuff like that that made me suddenly go, oh, okay, wait a minute. If there have been lies told, if things that happened during that time, now I have to look back on differently, what else was maybe bad? And so in a lot of ways, in every single way, the reason that my perception because that USADA report was the first time on paper I saw somebody say something was wrong. And it wasn't necessarily directly related to my experience, but it was this like allowance for me to suddenly go, wait, what was wrong in my situation?
And when your article came out then, because, you know, I mean, you're now in some ways a bigger name than you were as an athlete because of your article. Like, is, I don't want to use the word tainted because I think it's the wrong word, but are you labeled now as, you've turned almost from being a person to being Mary Kane, with that one story, you know, is that the case, or is that just how it seems?
That's a good question. I think that one story made me more known, but I think even when I was known just for my athletic accomplishments, like I was still in the figurative sense known as Mary Kane. Like I think, you know, my sharing my more personal journey through sport and the negative stuff I went through in some ways has like humanized the athlete in me. And I think even though there still is, you know, the disconnect between, like, I think in society, we often think we know people, but like you only know them if you, you know, have them over for dinner and get to meet them. And, you know, or even like, I think the advent of podcasts, in my view, has almost made people know me better than they ever could have just over Instagram or written articles. Mm. But yeah, I think it's an interesting question because I would say, in my view, people almost know me better now and know a bigger picture of me. But I would also say, I believe I don't know anybody unless I like really get to know them, which is funny because the track world's so small that there's certain people who you're like, yeah, I know them. And then you kind of take a step back and you're like, I've never actually met them. I don't think I really know them. So yeah, I guess a long-winded way of saying like a little bit of both, where like nobody ever really knew me unless they knew me, but this maybe let them see a little bit more of like my journey and who I am.
And which is, has this broken your relationship with running?
It did for a while, yeah. But I think it was more, I think at the heart of it, it broke my relationship with myself. This made it so that, you know, when you're told every single day for like 2 years you're a head case, you know, it's hard to trust yourself. And I think very creator who was like, I guess I'll name myself after a Greek myth. That person did not exist because of that time with NOP. And I think that's really sad. And I look back at those years and I just feel like so much of who I was stripped from me by them. And as soon as I was able to realize that and acknowledge that running in and of itself was just a trigger because it reminded me of these relationships and it reminded me of these times. And it was just this kind of like big way of like feeling closer to that. But it wasn't just in running. Like so many things in life, I was carrying their way of thinking about me and projecting it onto myself. And I would be lying if I said there are days where I don't still have that like little Oregon Project demon on my shoulder, you know, saying like, you're not good enough, you're a head case, all those sort of things. And I think that's what's cruelest about abuse is that it's not that it takes a thing like running away from you. More like it takes your relationship with yourself and it damages it. And so that is what I've had to rebuild. It's not whenever I've just tried to fix the running, it doesn't work. It's like I have to fix what they kind of put into me that made me think negatively about myself, made my see myself in a bad light. And so now I would say that like my relationship with running is actually pretty good, but it's not everything I want it to be, and not from a performance perspective, but just from that ability to say, hey, when you were 15 years old, you took so much joy out of this run, but your 25-year-old self is thinking, yeah, but you know, you could have done X, Y, and Z because that's what they used to tell you you could have done. And so it's still a learning process, but I'll say, I think my realization now that it's something so much darker and so much deeper in a way has almost helped me find a lot more joy again in running and in other things in life.
And just out of interest about like with your folks, did they witness fully this whole thing, like what was it like for them? Because I can imagine it would have quite an impact on them through it, or if not afterwards, to then hear.
Yeah. So I think, you know, for when it was like happening, I didn't tell my parents about it because you're this like early college kid, like I would get in trouble by the coaches if I told my parents anything and if they call the coaches. So for example, like early on that year, I, you know, called my mom upset and like not even in like a crying way, but just I was like, yeah, they're not letting me go to Europe. They said I'm too fat. And my mom was like, what? And I was like, yeah, they told me I'm too fat. Like I'm not allowed to go. I have to lose weight. Like that's why I am, you know, doing this whole training block. And you know, my parents called the coaches and were like, you can't tell Mary that. Like what the heck? Like that's super inappropriate. She just did really well. And what happened was afterwards I got yelled at. So I, over the course of that period of time with the Oregon Project, was really like very aggressively told, you can't tell your parents. Like you can't, anything we do. And it started to enter even into the, like, when I was brought in for that birth control appointment, I told them, I'm gonna talk to my parents. And it was kind of this like, no, you're not. Like, don't you trust me? Like, she's a doctor, do what she says kind of thing. And so I think they put a little bit of this like fear in me to talk to my parents. And I almost started I definitely stopped telling them things. And even once I was out of the Oregon Project, again, you know, once these patterns are so developed in you at such a young, vulnerable age, even if you're like out of the physical environment, you're not emotionally out of it. And so, you know, I didn't tell them everything. And all of the stories of things that I look back on now and make me super uncomfortable and upset, and I look back and I'm like, how did I not see it in the moment? Like, I didn't tell them that until after the USADA report came out. That was the moment I sat them down and was like, I'm going to be honest. Like, these things happened. And I honestly need help reframing them in my own head. And so I think for my parents, this whole experience has been so highly traumatic. And not from the, oh, you know, we wish Mary had accomplished X, Y, and Z in sport perspective. They could care less. Like, in some ways, my parents would probably, like, go do something, you know, like medicine with your life. But it's been from this just such sadness that they couldn't help me in those moments. And they couldn't help me partly because they didn't know, partly because people made it so that I felt scared to talk to them and be honest, but partly just as parents that love me, you know, they always want to protect me. And I think they just feel so much, you know, unfair guilt towards themselves that they somehow couldn't figure it out, you know, and weren't able to intervene sooner. And, you know, I think at this point, I'm always reminding them that, like, there's no reason for them to feel anything, almost negatively towards themselves or sadness that they didn't intervene. But I say this because, you know, Nike's first response to my New York Times piece story was, you know, her parents knew this was going on. Maybe they shouldn't have sent her there. And again, that's not an exact quote, but that's pretty much what they wrote. Mm-hmm. And I was so angry that they said that because I know how much my parents have almost suffered too from this, because it's really made them just feel so crushed that their daughter went through this. And to have a multi-billion dollar organization like blame my parents for something that they did not know about because they didn't see, they weren't there for, like, it's just so cruel. Because there were moments where my parents maybe had like the little warning signs and tried to intervene, but like it's tough. You know, it was like two people who do not run against a multi-billion dollar organization and the best coach in the world. Like, who do you think their 18-year-old daughter is going to listen to, you know?
And also it's the pull of an Olympic gold. I mean, it's that is the huge volume, right? It's the it's that desire that you need to have to be that level of athlete.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think that's why it's like I always remind my parents that they were a part of the incredibly integral moments that saved me and that got me out. And I'll be honest, I was not always happy with them during those moments. I was often very angry in a way, or very sad or very upset. But, you know, when I called them saying, hey, I have an eating disorder, I need help, they immediately booked me a flight and got me out of there. When my mom learned that I had been cutting myself, she'd made me leave the team officially and fully. And had neither of those moments happened, I don't know where I'd be right now. And every step of the way, like, you know, my mom especially, I'm going to give the shout out to, because she would be the one who, when I read the USADA report and I sat her down, I was like, we really need to talk. And by the end of me telling her a lot of very personal stories, some of which I'm not really ready to share publicly, about things that happened while I was there, you know, I told her, I'm like, I've emailed the New York Times reporter and she wants to meet me tomorrow. Like, I'm going to share this. Like, I'm going to talk about this publicly. And I told her, I'm never going to be paid to run again. Nobody's going to touch me with a 10-foot pole after this happens. Nobody's even going to read the whole thing. Because, like, who the hell would watch this video? Lo and behold, like, millions of people did. But I just told her, I was like, this is going to really change the trajectory of my life. But I can't live with the thought that somebody else out there might not know that they're in an abusive relationship. And my mom was like, how do I help? You know, like, there was never this, like, but you're running, like, you might win. What about the other sponsors? It's just from the beginning, it's been like, how can I help you as a person? And so shout out to my parents for really being a part of this crazy journey with me. And honestly, like, whether I'm, you know, was qualified for the world championships or running some like random fun run in New York City, always showing up with a hot dog in hand and having a great time.
And so for, I guess for parents then, if they're worried about their kids, but in controlling relationships, or, you know, are getting the balance wrong between food and not eating enough, or overtraining, or have you got any advice you'd give of telltale signs or things, ways to approach or things to say that would may have helped?
Yeah, I think one big I think there's like a couple different ways that parents can like protect themselves and protect their kids. And I think to start, it's like always do the due diligence to make sure you're truly working with professionals. And in my parents' case, like we did, it was just, we always had like the professional stamp by Nike, not necessarily the professional stamp by like medical institutions, right? And so like, you know, always make sure if you're working with somebody around food, like if you're here in the States, like, and I'm sure internationally, like there's similar kind of registrations, but like, you know, maybe talk to a registered dietitian. They're the people who have done like years of schooling, have to have certain licenses in order to really kind of work with people. You know, that's a great place to start when it comes to food conversations. If there's a barrier to entry to finding somebody, there's all sorts of like great resources online that you can find. Like there's this great nonprofit called Voice in Sport. Their acronym is VIS, V-I-S, where it's a way for people to like connect more with like experts or, you know, young girls to learn from people like registered dietitians. And I think that goes to categories beyond food. Like if you're, you know, bringing your kid to a doctor's appointment, like try to bring them to somebody who maybe has like worked with athletes before, or this is like kind of their area of expertise. You know, like those sort of things I think are always super duper important. And if your kid's coach or another parent or somebody is trying to give you like advice that should really be saved for professionals within the medical world, within the coaching world, et cetera, then just be aware to, you know, source that with a secondary person rather than just believing that, yeah, my kid's shin hurts, the coach said they can run through it. Don't just do it because somebody who has this job and maybe doesn't have credentialing is telling you to do it. So there's the kind of like speak to professionals side of things that I think is always really helpful. But I think things start in the house where like if your kid has suddenly dramatically gone from like kind of eating everything to suddenly only eating salads, or maybe really kind of talking to you a little bit about calories, or talking to you about you know, whether or not something's healthy or unhealthy, I think the earlier you're able to catch on to that and the earlier you're able to figure out, okay, what is going on? Is this something where the whole team is doing this and this is a conversation that needs to be had with the coach so that we can change the system? Is this something that they're kind of reading online, being influenced by? Is this something kind of like personally driven from another source? Those are all really kind of great things to figure out early so that you can really nip it in the bud. Because I think, you know, the whole diet culture is something that's always toxic, but for especially for young people who are in development years, you know, these are all things that affect bone growth. And there's a certain point where we kind of stop like really growing bone in the same way. If you disrupt your ability to develop during like key prime development years, you're never getting that back. And so these are things that like should be taken as seriously as like your kid breaking a bone, right? Like if that happens, you're immediately going to respond. You're immediately going to figure out what happened. How do we prevent this from happening? Take the same approach to anything mental health related, and make sure you know, have a system of people who you can lean on. And of course, it's frustrating, at least here in the States, that our healthcare system is one in which there's often barriers to entry to some of this, some of these, like, you know, things that should almost be accessible to all.
Especially with influencers on Instagram as well. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's why it's like more, you know, like, and this is something that I also want to do, is just kind of like create a resource center for people to know, like there are incredible nonprofits and charities and people who donate their time to people in need. And so just finding ways to make that more like public and present so that it's not, because sometimes I feel bad because I'm like, oh, go talk to your doctor. And the truth is not everybody can do that. So there's a lot of things we have to problem solve for, but kind of a long tangent.
And if you could, I guess if you could make wholesale changes, you know, resource wasn't an issue within athletics, coaching, within colleges, within relationships between coaches and sponsored athletes, brands and athletes. I mean, you're walking the walk with Atalanta, but if you could almost instill certain rules within other organizations, what kind of organization would it look like, and what kind of fail safes would you suggest people put in?
That's a really great question. I think first off, one thing I long-term want to develop is we have so many different coaching classes and credentialing that people are banned from, things like you have to do safe sport training for certain roles here, to just your kind of basic USATF level one coaching. And I want to create something that almost combines all of these things. It maybe is a resource tool for people who are kind of interested in getting into coaching. And it requires almost all sorts of steps for you to get a credentialing, and it becomes something that's required everywhere. Because I think what's really difficult here, and what has never been problem solved, is the fact that certain things like safe sport are great, right? But if you're in the NCAA and you're an NCAA coach, safe sport can't really do anything to you. They're not all of a sudden your governing body. They don't guide the decision making. And the NCAA hasn't made any rules yet to impose any form of abuse training for people. And so there's already so many people doing the right stuff and organizations doing the right stuff, but it's more, we have to figure out a way to make them universally required and enforceable. And right now there's almost all sorts of groups that don't, maybe one group acknowledges one rule book and another acknowledges another. And as a result, almost nothing's really enforceable, because somebody can just go, if they get banned from one place, go get a job in another. Or if they, don't have the required credentialing to work with students here, they go somewhere else. And I think that whole idea of just making everything under one umbrella is the best way to protect people. And just as it stands right now, that's almost more of a, to me, something that would be solved by lobbying to these organizations and kind of getting in the NCAA's face and saying, why don't you care about sexual abuse? Why don't you follow safe sport rules? Why aren't you enforceable by them? And maybe if we got in their face, we would learn really, really great reasons. Maybe there are certain things that need to be solved for. And so how do we get each of these groups to kind of get a little closer together so that we can create this big enforceable umbrella and then take it overseas? Because I don't just care about American athletes. This should be something that it doesn't matter where you're from. If you're an athlete, you can have this education and this support.
I mean, the billion coaches, it's weird. It's like we've known this for years. It's a stereotype in films, TV shows. It's almost accepted because it's so common. I mean, what would you say to people who would argue that you almost need that kind of pressure to forge gold?
I would say, look at all the times that isn't the case. I think, one benefit of maybe kind of going down this path that I'm going down right now in 2021 is that you're suddenly starting to see examples of athletes who are coached in really healthy dynamics, and they have great relationships with their teammates, and their sponsors are kind to them, and they prioritize their mental health, and they still win, right? So I think it's something where, it's not exactly I'm sharing this newfangled thing that has never worked before. It's more there are people who are miserable and being treated who win, But there's also some people who are having a great time and treated really well and everything's super positive. So to me, I'm like, why not that just be the norm? Why not that just be the thing that we promote and prioritize? Because honestly, I think it would just make everything more competitive. Because all of the people who take one look at sports right now and they're like, God, so 50 to 100% of things I can't even do because I'm a woman. And then the few things I can, I'm probably going to be like mistreated in and criticized. Like, woo, I'm going to put my talent somewhere else. Right. And unfortunately, as a woman, a lot of industries, this is the case. This isn't like a unique to sport sort of thing. But still, we're almost like we're losing good talent because people are just looking at this and saying, like, why should I do it? You know, even if they have the drive, even if they have the will, they have the want, you know, they walk away. And to me, I'm like, the more we just like promote and encourage and share the stories of people who are doing it really positively and really beautifully, the more that kind of person who used to walk away is going to say, hell yeah, I'm your future teammate. I'm joining you soon.
And what's your kind of view on how, well, what's your feeling towards Nike now? And what's your view on how, you know, the average listener should really feel about Nike themselves and what you think they morally should be doing?
I think it, like, I've always looked at this and always shared with people that I think the most important thing that you can walk away from my story from is just ask yourself, how can I make the teams, you know, companies that I work for, the clubs that I'm a part of, whatever is kind of your immediate circle, and how can I make them better, right? Like, I don't expect people to go almost problem solve for, like, issues that are outside of their own bubbles. I think if every single one of us could look at the company we worked for, look at the school we went to, look at our friend group and our teams and say, hey, how can we make this more positive? How can we make sure we're, you know, protecting each other? How can we make sure it's more inclusive? I think over the course of this probably like 2-hour conversation, we've talked about so many different issues that aren't unique to sport always, right? Like certain things I went through were unique, aggressive, like specific, but, you know, the idea of women having less opportunities, being treated less seriously, that happens in business, that happens in medicine, that happens in insert any industry. And so I almost hope, rather than people like taking my story and directing it into anger that they just kind of feel is uncontrollable and they have no, you know, kind of say in, I would much rather people look at my story and say, okay, I'm going to join our DEI department within our group. I'm going to petition to make sure that our high school track club coach is Safe Sport certified. I'm going to talk to my friends and ask them, like, who are the people you're following? Who are the people you're lifting up? You know, even through simple things like social media, you know, like, are you following the person who says they're eating 3 grapes a day? Or are you following the person, you know, like a Molly Seidel, who's been super vocal about, you know, her own struggles with things like eating disorders, and now is doing really good things and showing you that you can be healthy, you can be happy, and you can win. And so I would say it's more of those like active day-to-day like changes that you can be a part of is what I want people to think about, rather than almost things that are kind of beyond what I think will make that like really true impact. And if every single person who has ever listened to my story did that, holy crap, can you imagine the amount of like change we'd be able to make? You know, can you imagine the number of like high school teams that would suddenly have such a positive experience because their alumni would go reach out, or the organizations that, you know, people are a part of and work for? So yeah, that's I think my dream is just that, you know, this becomes an exponential group of people trying to fix things.
Well, I mean, amen to that. And that is a great dream to have. And I truly think that you're working your way towards making that happen. If people want to, I guess, follow you, follow Atalanta, or even get involved in Atalanta and help Atalanta? What's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah, so there's a few different ways. We are on social media. Don't worry, I'm not the only one running it. So we're answering messages and everything. we're on Instagram and Twitter at AtalantaNY. And we're also online. We have our website, atalantanyc.org. And on there, you can learn more about what we're doing. We're going to keep it more up to date. And hopefully be releasing some information soon about our service programming, ways people can potentially volunteer. But if you want to reach out in a more direct way, we have an email on the website you can reach out to. It's contact@atalantany.com. That's really kind of the best email to reach us. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, throw them at us. And then on there, we also have two other ways that people can be more like financially support. We do have the opportunity for people to donate if they're, you know, supporting what we're doing and interested in kind of getting involved in like our newsletters online. And then also we have unveiled a training team where John Green, who's our head coach,
where he's writing training plans for really kind of the local running community. And by local, I mean, you can be from all over the world and be a part of it, but it's just our way to kind of grow our team and the number of people who are really a part of it.
Amazing. And we've had quite a few questions. We've covered them mostly, thankfully. But a few people are wondering what your dog's name is.
Dog's name is, yeah, Nala.
Why Nala?
I think this is like a little bit of a joke between my boyfriend and I, but I grew up watching all sorts of Disney movies and loved them. And the only one my boyfriend watched was The Lion King. And he loved it. He was like, great show. And so when we were just brainstorming names, he's like, if you want a Disney name, Nala's the best. And it's awesome because she's such a little lion that it's perfect.
She the female lion?
Yes.
I've got to say, she's pretty hot for a lion, for a cartoon lion.
Weird thing
he's
to
chosen
say.
Well.
There we go. She's
my,
pretty hot for a female lion. What?
She's my cartoon crush. Anyway. Well, Mary, thanks so much for coming on. It's been amazing, and you know, thank you for sharing so candidly as well, because I realise that's will be quite draining for you emotionally to have to, you know, go through that for such a long time. But please stay in touch. Please let us know if there's future initiatives and things we can help with or get involved with. And from all the listeners, thank you so much.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Thanks for having me, and always happy to talk about this stuff. I think it's super important. And no matter, I think, how hard it is for me, I think I get back so much by talking about it and sharing and knowing. Again, maybe all of your listeners will be inspired by that last tidbit of go out and change the world yourself too.
Absolutely. Well, good luck with it all, and I hope to speak to you at some point in the near future.
Thanks.
Wow. I've been trying to get her on for quite a while, and so honest about everything. It's strange, you know. I've read her story, I've heard her story, but you just forget. You know, she was so young.
Yeah,
she went through all this.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of crazy, isn't it? I'm glad she addressed the whole thing about with her parents and stuff. I didn't realise that Nike had. That's what they said. That was their statement about. I mean, that is unbelievable, isn't it? But also yeah. Not surprising in the slightest.
Yeah, it's basically, you knew we were monsters, and yet you sent your daughter
exactly.
to
I know.
Hell.
It's just
how
the,
bad are you? It's not our problem with all, devils.
All the bullying and like every single abuser they talk about, the first thing they say is that they say to them, don't tell your parents about this. Don't tell your parents about, I mean,
like
it's literally
like cults,
the MO
it?
Of every abuser.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's just like cult activity, like isolate, control, and and actually, the she's making such an impact already so quickly. I mean, she's clearly ridiculously intelligent, but it's going to be great to see what impact this race team has, because a lot of it is just raising the bar for sponsors to have to compete with. And if they can grow and suddenly are a major force in US athletics, that is so powerful, because suddenly your Nikes, your Adidases, they're going to have to change. And not just change for the top athletes, they're going to have to change for all athletes.
Hilarious, David. Hilarious.
True, true.
Oh, you dreamer, you.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the crazy thing, is she's still, you know, relatively young.
She's incredibly young, isn't it? You keep thinking, oh God, at 25, you're so badly, you could be so badly treated. Like, yeah, she wasn't 25 at the time. I mean, it's horrific. It's unbelievable. Yet weirdly believable and all too common still.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's you don't really hear these stories from successful athletes. I think Chrissy was quite unusual in saying that. And then the unsuccessful didn't hear from. So it's so hard to actually know how common this is. We won't do too long a recap on this one, just because Mary's story's been so great that we've been 2 hours, well, maybe longer actually. But if you like this episode, then we mentioned the Chrissy Wellington episode. That was incredible as well, where she went into her story all the way through to her first world championship win. And
it was a surprising
that's amazing
podcast.
As well.
It was a surprising podcast. We had no idea it was going to go down that route when we started chatting about that. But yeah, it was a really interesting, just the way it was uncovered.
Yeah, massively. And other ones that touch on similar issues. Nina McGregor's really good. She talks about, she's a nutritionist for the GB 24-hour. And she talks about the role of food, the importance of having periods and calories, all things like that, and to do with kind of training. Jake Smith actually as well. The topic was to do with running a marathon qualifying Olympic time on your first marathon when you're running as a pacer. But he then went into his youth where he was a triathlete and the amount he was training, the massive overtraining he was doing, because he was looking at Strava. He didn't have a coach. He was watching Strava and he was doing what he thought he was going to do, but also he was in a similar mindset to Salazar in some ways, in that he thought that the secret to getting quicker was losing weight and how he got stress fractures, and seems to be really common, but those episodes are really, really good. And then Adam Devlin, who spoke about eating disorders explicitly that was the theme of the episode. So yeah, lots of other episodes if you wanted to find out more or to hear some other stories along those lines. But if you'd like us to interview people in the future, then please message me either letters@badboyrunning.com, David@, or you can go onto Instagram and message me directly. Also follow us on Instagram if you want to ask questions to our future guests. We incorporated all of the messages and questions that you'd asked into this one, but a lot of the time we'll ask questions at the end. So follow us there to be able to ask questions to the guests in the future.
If you want to have a conversation with the other Dude Badders about this or any other subject that may affect you or your family, you can always head over to the Facebook group. You type in Bad Boy Running Podcast into Facebook, answer 3 questions, and you can jump into the group.
And we've also got some merch, I believe. Don't we, Jim? I don't know why I'm saying this. I know nothing about it. Have we got any Russian tops back in?
Oh, my goodness. I still can't believe how popular those Russian tops are. We've got some... We're having a bit of a merch revamp as well. So we've got a lot of new stuff coming in very, very soon, like new stickers, new flags, lots of different things as well. So if you're coming to the running show, National Running Show, you're going to see some of these things for the first time because we're going to be selling them there. So save up your pocket money and come along to the running show, and you'll be able to buy some treats.
Absolutely. And if you haven't subscribed, please do. If you haven't reviewed us, then please also do, mainly because it allows us to, it gives us the profile in people's eyes that means that when we message people like Mary, they message us back. And so we can
eventually
get good guests in the future.
Eventually.
Eventually. Thank goodness she did. I think it's my second message, actually. Persistence. Persistence is keeping. But thanks for listening, guys. And we'll speak to you next time.
We will explore the comment that David left us with, that Nala was his... was it sexy? What did you say? Your animated lion crush. We'll explore that. We'll explore that. On another podcast episode.
I'm sure that was in Wayne's World when they talk about it. Didn't he fancy?
Oh, what, when Bugs Bunny dressed up as a girl?
Dressed up as a girl. Not as my equivalent. Well,
we have to explore this further, because I think there's some way to go, and I'm sure Doobanners will jump in on this most attractive animated character.
And you know that someone right now is googling Nala and Gain.
That is one sexy animated.
That is
lion.
One. I don't normally fancy lions, but. Times are changing. But thanks for listening, guys, and we will speak to you next time.
See you later.
Bye bye.
I must admit I was a clone to be messing around. But that doesn't mean that you have to leave town. Yes, and give me one more try, 'cause a love like this should I never ever die. Come back.
Fuck you, buddy.